This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. My name is Chua Entik. You're listening to Live and Learn. My guest today is Rawan Daman, award-winning filmmaker whose documentaries include Bitter Peace, Homeland Owners, and The Price of Oslo, among others. She's here in Malaysia in conjunction with Palestinian Advocacy Week at the invitation of BCOM, and she will be collaborating with many NGOs who are collectively working on bringing justice to Palestinians. Rawan, you're based in Jordan, where you're born to Palestinian parents. I was wondering if I can begin with you maybe telling us what was your childhood like and how central was Palestine to your identity growing up?
It was very, very central. I had a very happy nuclear family. My parents, my dad was a civil engineer, my mom an economist, and I had one younger sister and brother. And we were raised up that, yes, we are born in Amman, Jordan, and we have Jordanian passports, but we are originally Palestinians. And that everybody who is born everywhere outside of historical Palestine and have passports from American, British, Malaysian, Jordanian passports should always say, we are Palestinians, because the Zionist project wanted to omit and erase Palestine from the international atlas and map. So if you open any atlas today, like international world map, you will not find Palestine. It's not there. And this thing was implemented in us when we were so young, I think. And this is why I became very passionate that I need to work for my homeland and do something. And later on, when I became a filmmaker and a media consultant, my tool was to do documentaries on Palestine and to help others do stories and documentaries on Palestine. So later, when I worked for 10 years with Al Jazeera Media Network in Doha, Qatar, I was a commissioner of tens of documentaries on Palestine done by other filmmakers. And I was keen to have those documentaries not only in the Arabic language, where what we speak in the Arab world, but also in English as an international language to reach audiences all over the world.
At what age did you become aware of a need to speak for this homeland?
Very, very early. I remember when I was 8 years old, I was doing like a speech on behalf of children. And after that, an Egyptian journalist came to me for a magazine called October Magazine. And she asked me, from where are you? And I told her, I am born in Amman, Jordan, but I am Palestinian. It was my parents who always showed us. We were always visiting Palestine. So this helped. Every summer in the vacation, we will go to Palestine. My original city is Nablus in the Palestinian occupied territories in the West Bank. And we have aunts, I have my grandma there. So it was a genuine childhood memories that we had of Palestine itself.
You were trained in media and sociology. Did you always intend to go into media? Was that always you thought was your calling to tell stories about Palestinian issues?
At the beginning, my sister and I worked on oral history. It was a very fashionable thing in the mid of 90s for Palestinians when they discovered that the eyewitnesses of the 1948 Nakba are dying. Nowadays, we have only 10% of those people who witnessed the ethnic cleansing and genocide that happened in 1948. So at that time, when we were at the secondary school and even smaller, we were very interested in oral history to gather those stories and rewrite them and publish them. And we published two books, Palestinian Memories Before 1948 and Expulsion in the Memories of Children. So I was more in writing in newspapers, first in the children pages and then, you know, in more adult pages. And I did acted in a drama series for TV when I was 8 years old. I loved the camera, but I didn't decide to do media. Then after I finished the secondary school, and in our system we have scientific and arts, I was in the scientific stream, and I was one of the top students. So my friends and so wanted me to go study medicine, engineer, pharmacy and so on. And I said, no, I want to go to the human sciences faculty and the arts faculty. And I was keen to combine things. And I think by the age of 16, 17, I said the best is to do a combination between sociology and media. Because media is not a science. It's a set of skills. And sociology is more a theoretical base of understanding the society. Media alone, without understanding the society, will be a tool that is not very useful. And I studied at Bir Zeit University inside Palestine in the West Bank under the Israeli occupation. And it was a very, very interesting experience to be a student and facing Israeli soldiers on the way to the university. It teaches you what is the meaning of colonization and settler colonization when you see the Zionist settlers there and how they prevent you to go to your university to learn. And they don't want the education to really prospect us. And I felt more and more the need that I would need to continue this and make it. And I did my first documentary while I was in the undergraduate studies. It was called Waiting for Light. It's on YouTube. It's a 10-minute documentary about a Christian family in the West Bank, in Ramallah, who are not allowed to go for the Easter celebrations in Jerusalem in April. And it was sent to Milano Film Festival in Italy. And at that time, I discovered that maybe documentaries is the tool. Because I thought that news and talk shows die quickly. Documentaries is the only thing that can have a long shelf thing. And then I can reuse the same documentary again for other things. Drama, of course, is the same, but it's so expensive to have an industry of drama in Palestine. And this is why I think since 1999, the year 2000, for the last 17 years, I've been more into documentaries.
Is that a common narrative of someone who's living outside to come back, whether through work or study, and then re-encounter what it is to be a Palestinian?
Million of Palestinian refugees, around 7 million Palestinian refugees abroad, are not allowed to go even to visit Palestine. So you are not allowed because your grandparents were kicked out, expelled from Palestine in 1948. So you are not allowed to go visit Palestine. So many of them dream of Palestine, but they never can go there. And some who can with foreigner passports, when they go to the airport, the Israeli airport, they are not allowed in because they are originally Palestinian. I am not a Palestinian refugee. My parents are from Nablus, which is the 1967 area. And we have this ID that can allow you to go visit and live in the West Bank. Not a lot of Palestinians have this privilege. But I am not allowed, for example, to visit Jerusalem. So still, I cannot live anywhere in Palestine. I can live in a specific place of Palestine. And so even for Jerusalem, which is the cultural, religious, your citizenship identity of your capital, you are not allowed to visit even for worship or even to see Jerusalem. So you still feel you cannot see Palestine. And this is why when I managed to visit Java, Akka, Jerusalem, for media purposes, when I worked for my documentary, especially Owners of the Land, a 5 hours documentary, or Al-Nakba about Palestine, 4 hours documentary translated to over 10 languages, I always feel that I miss Palestine, even when I am there. And even when you see Palestine under colonization and occupation, you still feel while you are inside that it is not there, as if you are missing it. So I'm not sure if it is a privilege to see Palestine or maybe the agony and the pain when you are outside and not allowed to see it is less. So I always think about, you know, the percentage of pain. And I think every Palestinian, even abroad, feel he or she misses something. Because our homeland was taken, and even if you live in Kuala Lumpur and you are happy and have your career and work and everything, you always think as a Palestinian, why everybody else can go back to their homeland, visit, have, you know, family ties, wherever they are originally from, or even visit their root place, and I cannot.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because for the entirety of your life, there is no Palestine. So the idea that you would miss this homeland that you only see through maybe images or news clippings or documentaries, what is it that you miss?
Palestine was there only less than 70 years ago. If you opened any international atlas in 1947, there will be Palestine. It's not a faraway memory. There was Palestine where you had cities, urban life, cinemas, poems, intellectual books. Those books are still there. And Arabic language, you know, we can read Arabic language of more than 2,000 years ago. The Arabic language is not like English and Latin. No, it's a very connected thing. So Palestine is there culturally. You cannot omit something in 70 years and tell people just forget about it. So basically what happened is that Palestine was replaced by Israel via a long history of planning for Zionism as a settler colonization movement. And then Israel nowadays is a settler Zionist project that is still going on. I mean, colonization did not end. And the second thing that makes the Palestinians always remember Palestine, that the killing and the arrestment of people and the discrimination, apartheid, the inhumane regime is still there. Maybe, you know, if this erasing of Palestine happened and then things calmed down, people will not every day remember. But nowadays we have over 7,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, and 700,000 Palestinians have witnessed this Israeli jails in the last 50 years. So people are kept remembering this because the Zionist movement is still trying to dispossess the Palestinians and expel them. It didn't happen once and that's it. It's a daily thing. It's a long process. It's a slow thing. So even your relatives, your friends, your people, your nation are under this continuous colonization until today. So how can you forget, even if you are far away?
I'm speaking today to Rawan Daman, a filmmaker whose documentaries have shed light on the history of Palestine, the displacement of the Palestinian diaspora, and how those two fit within the politics of the Middle East today. We'll talk more after this short break. BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Untik. My guest today is Rawan Daman, a documentary filmmaker and media consultant who's here in Malaysia to engage the various NGOs working for justice in Palestine. Rawan's family, who's originally from the city of Nablus in the West Bank, moved to Jordan in the early 70s because her parents accepted jobs in Amman. She would go on to work as a broadcaster in both Jordan and Palestine. Rawan, what is the media landscape there like? Is there room for dissent?
Yeah, it's, you know, especially in Palestine, because of the colonization and occupation, there is a lot of stories. And this is why, as a media person, you have a lot to say. In every corner, we say in Palestine, you can find a story. A boy arrested at home, a woman who lost her land, a farmer who lost his trees, a settlers who took a land. And it's a daily thing. It's happening every day. So you have TV, radio, press, everything. But I think that we have a lot of media people and media landscape in Arabic language, not enough in English language, and not enough in the way to tell the story. I think because it has been a struggle for over 100 years, Palestinians themselves get depressed and they said, okay, we have spoken, we have written about this for the last 100 years and nothing happened. So we have people like Najib Nassar, a very famous Palestinian journalist, who started writing against Zionism in 1911. We have still the newspapers, the article he had been, you know, publishing. So people, I think, got depressed. Even the audiences, the world got depressed of this story that doesn't end. We heard about Palestine, okay, and Israel, what's happening? We are hopeful things will go better, but they never go better, even they get worse. So nowadays, what we need is to change the way we tell the story. I think this story needs to be told more via people and persons rather than by numbers and agonies. There's a lot of happiness in Palestine. Many people have love stories, get married, kids go to school, they succeed in spite of everything. And in fact, because of everything, because when you feel that there is the Zionist project that doesn't want you, they want you to disappear, you feel, no, I want to stay more and do something more and succeed more, and gives you more persistence. So the media is, many colleagues are doing very well, but in like the big picture, the story of Palestine is not in the right place.
When you were in Al Jazeera, were you working in the Arabic or English service?
I was working in the Arabic service all the time, 10 years, but I had very good colleagues in the Al Jazeera English, whom slowly were convinced to take the documentaries about Palestine done in Arabic and translate them and broadcast them on Al Jazeera English, which was a big thing, a very important thing. We managed to have tens of excellent documentaries from Arabic translated, reversioned into English. For example, when we say in Arabic Nablus, everybody knows. But in English, you need to say Nablus in the West Bank occupied territories. So it needs a bit of reversion to be understandable. And I managed to head a team to gather some of those excellent documentaries under a project called Palestine Remix. So now we have them all in Arabic, English, Bosnian and Turkish under PalestineRemix.com. PalestineRemix.com is a platform where you have the full documentaries with the full transcript. So you can search the word you like. You can put Nablus and reach to every single place Nablus was mentioned in all the documentaries. Cut and paste, mix and match, take an extract from this documentary, another extract from another, mix them together, do your own story about Palestine, share it on social media, or even download and take this file with you. So I was very keen to get those documentaries to people. They are, all of them are free on YouTube, but even this people are not aware of. They don't know that those documentaries do exist. Like Al-Nakba documentary, it has been there for the last 8 years in English. But how many people watch those four hours of documentaries? When I tell even my friends, they say, 4 hours, Rawan, do you think that we can listen to and watch 4 hours? So I decided that Palestine Remix might be the best idea. Then people can watch 1 minute, do their 5 minutes, 30 seconds. It seems that the attention span for people all over the world became much shorter. And even, you know, radio programs, they want them shorter and shorter. And it's so funny, you know, that people want to understand and go deep into the subject. And at the same time, they want the quick bits of it.
Does that make your work more difficult?
Yeah, because you need to adapt. Yeah, you need to adapt to the quick speed of our days today. People seem to have everything, you know, they will have time to go and sit in the coffee with their friends for 2 hours and they will not feel that it's a long time. But then if you ask them to watch a 2 hours documentary, they say, oh, that's so long. And their perception of documentaries that they are not entertaining or they are not, you know, engaging enough. So we need to, I think the best way is to get them involved in the short bits at the beginning and then to lead them to the longer, especially for the activists who can later on use other means to reach to the wider audience. You don't need everybody to know everything about everything. You cannot do this, but at least people who are interested, people who can be influential, people who can change, they need to have access to this. Nowadays we have a lot, you know, in every minute we have around 400 hours of new content on YouTube. The content is so huge. So you need to at least guide people where to go if they need this content.
Yeah, because you don't want to trivialize it, right? Do you also strive to entertain?
Yeah, at least you need to have a story that is engaging. So in documentaries, we use drama techniques to make people engage. You need to have music, you need to have sound effects, you need to have good sound bites, good content, archive that is really verified. In documentaries, you need to verify every single information, because if there is only half an information that is wrong, you will lose all of your audience because of this mistake in information. And this is why it takes around a year, sometimes a couple of years, to finish one documentary.
Al Jazeera was one of the reasons that was given by the Saudi-led blockade against Doha. What was your thoughts?
It was funny, you know. Al Jazeera is a big institution. It started in 1996. It's now going for over 20 years with the Arabic service first and then the English service for the last 10 years.
And what we see in the English service is quite different from what goes on in the Arabic.
Because it's a different audience, of course. You know, there's a many reversion for the documentaries, especially from English to Arabic and from Arabic to English. But you cannot reversion talk shows or news. Reports in all broadcasters. But the spirit of all Al Jazeera network is one. Like Palestine Remix was Al Jazeera network project, not connected to one service. And I worked within the network for 10 years, and I think that many colleagues there are trying their best to do many good things. And for every media institution, when they feel under threat, they excel more. So I think the colleagues, when they heard this, I called them, I said, how are things, you know, in Doha and so? And they said, we are very glad that they want to close us. We want to continue working, you know, because when you feel that you are under threat, then you want to prove yourself much more. And it's very sad that even in 2017, we have people that think to close and shut down any media broadcaster. It means that we are still in a situation where people don't believe in the basic human rights of freedom of speech.
A lot of commentaries have written about the good work that Al Jazeera is doing, shedding light on stories that are not told by state medias around the Gulf region. But one criticism is that it trains a critical lens on each of Doha's neighbor except Doha itself. What was the newsroom like when you were working there? Is there an unspoken rule not to look within Qatar?
From the beginning, from 1996, it was a very agreement between the state of Qatar, who initiated Al Jazeera, and Al Jazeera in general, that this is not a local broadcaster. This is not a broadcaster that will focus on Qatar. Because Qatar has its TV station, radio stations, etc. And basically Al Jazeera never was targeting the GCC. It was more targeting the pan-Arab audience. So if there is a very small issue in Morocco, let's say, Al Jazeera will not care about this. It will care when the audience from Bahrain to Morocco will have this as a priority on the agenda. So it's a pan-Arab thing. And many other pan-Arab stations came. It's so special because in the Arab world, you have 22 different countries speaking Arabic language. So that was the main thing behind it. So when you have a percentage analyzing what Al Jazeera covered, you will see that they covered much less GCC in general, all of it, including Qatar. So unless in Qatar there is a big thing that's happening, Al Jazeera will not cover it. And I always used to tell other colleagues in other GCC broadcasters when they have this criticism, for many, many years it has been going on, I say, okay, you in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, come and cover Qatar. If Qatar is so important to cover, let other GCC countries cover it, you know. For the Palestinian issue, because I never worked in news, so I was never part of the newsroom. I always worked in programs and documentaries. But in documentaries, my experience was so good that I never had any issue covering the story of Palestine. So I was never told, no, you cannot talk about this, about Palestine.
That's fair enough. I don't mean to put you in this position where you have to defend
Al Jazeera.
So usually when a crisis like this happened, like in this instance, a blockade led by Saudi Arabia against Qatar, the Americans would usually step in and broker maybe a solution that is face-saving to all parties. But the current administration, the U.S. administration, is like no other. What are your opinions of the current Trump administration on their policy towards the Middle East?
the relationship between the Zionism as a movement and the States of America started in 1942. Until then, the Zionism was had, you know, the partnership, let's say, with the UK, with Britain. But later on, Zionism understood that Britain is going falling down as an empire, and there is a new empire, that is the United States of America. So they started to establish excellent relations with both the Democratic and the Republican parties, and these excellent relations are still the same today. So the Arabs, including the Palestinians, do think that, okay, let's have a broker in this, you know, peace negotiations, and that is a neutral party, which is the United States of America. It's not neutral. It's taking care of Zionism and of Israel since 1942 until today. And this was proved many, many times when they vetoed many of the UN resolutions to take care of the Zionist movement. And so if Palestinians in the 20s and the 30s used to go have negotiations in London with the British government to solve the issue of Palestine, it didn't work, of course, because Britain's main mission with the British mandate in 1922 was to transfer Palestine into a Zionist Jewish state. That was the main thing. They came and they got 70,000 soldiers in Palestine to implement this, because it couldn't be implemented otherwise. How come you have Jews in Palestine 3%, and then they became, by the end of the mandate, 500,000 Zionist settlers amongst 2 million Palestinians? And even with 500,000, who owned 7% of the land, how can you transfer this country to a Jewish Zionist state unless you have the expulsion, the genocide, and the disposition and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians? This was done under the eyes of both Britain and the United States of America. So nothing changed until now. And this is why when a new president comes, a new administration, people start hopeful or not hopeful about what's happening. I always thought this is a systematic thing. You cannot change this unless you have a real change in the relationship, strategic relationship, between the Zionism and the colonization powers, new colonization powers and old colonization powers. So I think this applies everywhere in the Middle East, that the United States has never been a neutral part in any negotiations.
Did the mass immigration started because of the 1917 Balfour Declaration?
The first Aliyah, it's called in the Hebrew literature, started in 1884 until 1914. At that time, in 1882, the first Zionist settler groups came into Palestine, which was, of course, both Muslims and Christian Palestinians, by the end of the Ottoman rule. And during the First World War, during the World War I, the negotiations between the Zionist movement and the British government began to formulate the Balfour Declaration. And with the Balfour Declaration 100 years ago in 1917, which Arthur Balfour, who is the foreign minister of Britain, issued to Lord Rothschild, one of the most rich British Jewish Zionist people in Britain, this letter became like a political tool used with the British mandate coming in force in Palestine to implement the mass immigration. So in the 20s and the 30s, European settlers from all over Europe came into Palestine every single year, and the British mandate gave them Palestinian passports because it was Palestine. So the Jewish Zionist settlers, each of them arriving on the port of Jaffa or Haifa, received a Palestinian passport. And the British mandate used to have an annual report to the UN telling them every single year what they did to transfer Palestine into a Jewish state. And the British mandate managed to scratch and smash all the Palestinian revolutions in the 20s and the 30s, including a big revolution that happened from 1936 until 1939, where 5,000 Palestinians were killed, and all the leadership of the Palestinians, both politically and military, were expelled outside of Palestine. So by 1939, Palestinians lost their way to get Palestine not to be a Zionist Jewish state by the power, military power of the British Mandate. And later in 1948, Israel was announced, and they call it inside Israel the liberation of Israel. Liberated from whom? We don't know. Because Israel was never occupied by anybody. Israel, in reality, was the name that was invented in May 1948, it wasn't there before, even in the literature, to replace the word Palestine. And now when you speak with any politician, especially European politician, the word Palestine, he looks at you and say, oh, what do you mean by Palestine? As if this word vanished.
I bring up the Balfour Declaration because November 2nd is the 100th anniversary of it. What is the UK government as well as European leaders' view on Balfour today?
Yeah, it's a big agony that the Zionist movement, along with the British government, are doing huge celebrations for the 100th anniversary. They are calling the Zionists to go on street parties and to have musical parties, have big celebrations in Jerusalem and in the UK. And this is why I'm part of a popular conference for Palestinians abroad, where we are planning to have a digital and a field campaign just to say Balfour is a colonial project. And how come you celebrate a colonization that is a history that we thought people will have an apology of and say, you know, in 2017, 100 years from that time, we really don't want to remember this colonization period, and we really think that colonization should not be part of our today's world. It was a big surprise. Usually the Zionists themselves, they tell you when you discuss with them, we don't speak about the history. Let's talk about today. Why you are talking about the history? They are themselves who are celebrating Balfour 100 years back, to which means that this history is part of today. That idea of the settler colonization is still the same idea today. And this is why I think Palestinians and pro-Palestinians should have a say in this and tell the British government that it's really a big surprise for all of us to get the British government involved in such celebrations.
What is an acceptable end goal to you? What, if you are for the two-state solution, what boundaries would be acceptable to you?
I think the two-state solution is a dead thing. It will never happen. The settler colonizations inside the occupied West Bank is everywhere. And the 1967 is not the beginning of the story. The beginning of the story was in the expulsion itself in 1948, which is almost like the end of the planning of the Zionist movement. And this is why the solution should start from 1948. And this is why the one-state solution is the only applicable solution nowadays. The two-state solution, although it's acceptable by many people and the UN, and it will not solve the problem. Jaffa, Haifa, for Palestinians is part of their dream. And the one-state solution is the only one. Now you have Zionist settlers, Jewish, who are the fifth generation. Their grand-grandparent came in 1882, which means they are Palestinians now. They are there, and they will not go anywhere. And the Zionist movement need to understand that it should not be a racial movement. It shouldn't have this pure Jewish-only place. Palestinians, Muslims, Christians, Jews, everywhere can live in any country with the same rights and human rights. Unless this happens, no solution will be in this place.
Rowan Daman, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.